I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast, Cold. Don't miss Cold's new Season 3, where I look into the unsolved disappearance of Cherie Warren, a woman last seen leaving her job at a Salt Lake City office in 1985. Police cast suspicion on Cherie's estranged husband and boyfriend, but never made any arrests or recovered Cherie's remains. Find Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie, anywhere you get your podcasts.
Utah's best athletes count on flexibility, speed, strength.
And the Jazz pick up their 22nd assist.
So they count on University of Utah Health.
Real Salt Lake puts this game away.
And so can you. Leading doctors, a world-class environment, award-winning innovation, care to be great.
14 unanswered by the Utes.
University of Utah Health, caring for Utah's best and yours. Schedule your appointment now at uofuhealth.org/care to be great.
All right, welcome into a Friday edition of the Jazz Notes podcast. My name is Klingon Wall, and Ben Anderson is sitting here with me. A little nice listening for you either on this Friday or maybe this weekend. The Utah Jazz are getting ready to play the Memphis Grizzlies, but we're going to talk about some evergreen things right now. First of all, though, Ben actually watched very intently. I did not that night. I took the night off, watched very intently the Jazz take on the Brooklyn Nets. It was an interesting game, Ben, because as I was passively paying attention to it, I wasn't surprised that the Jazz, you know, didn't lead because they got back late.
Yep.
They had an earlier game in the day. But I'm also not surprised that they pulled this game out. You actually wrote something about this, about it didn't quite go to script what we've seen the Jazz this season. They kind of flipped things around and they were able to pull out the win because they were able to turn things on in the second half.
Yeah, Jazz have been a very good first quarter team through the first 10 games of the season. Of course, that was the 11th game. They'd been a very good first quarter team, I think, like second in the NBA as far as scoring margin. They were leading teams by an average of 4 points per game after one quarter, which is a nice start to every game. And then they were down, 10 or something, I think, after the first quarter against Brooklyn. They were just slow to start, and the defense was bad. Brooklyn was well into the 30s at the end of the first. And then the Jazz have traditionally been a bad fourth quarter team, at least they have so far this season. And then they outscored Brooklyn by 10 again in this fourth quarter. So I know it's early. It's hard to pick up on trends that heavily at this point in the season, but it's nice to know that the Jazz can work on things and figure things out and overcome when the game doesn't go according to script. They can still fix it late, which is what they did in the fourth quarter. You know, they were down 15 at the half, down 8, I think, after the third quarter, and still found a way to come back and get the victory. So it's more about just the idea that the Jazz are pretty adaptable regardless of the situation they're finding themselves in this year. And we talked about that on the last podcast, or just how quickly the Jazz learn to fix problems. And I mean, that's an example of in a game, the Jazz changing one problem in one quarter to fixing that in the fourth quarter, and just the adaptability and the customization that Dennis Lindsay talked about with Quinn Snyder and this offense and this team of how we can get things working.
And Rudy Gobert, of course, shut me up. I said, I want to see more from Rudy. Yep. And I said, I'm probably unfair to him. And then he goes out and he has a wonderful game. And when I did Jazz Notes for KSL News Radio the next morning, I focused on his put back off of a Donovan miss and how well he played in that game. He did miss quite a few free throws, if I've got that right, but he still played really well in that game. But maybe the turning point, and you can speak to this a little bit more, is the fact that Emmanuel Mudiay and Jeff Green at the start of the fourth quarter played fantastic, better than, of course, the Nets were playing at that time. And it's good to see the Jazz bench players playing that well.
With those two had 19 points in the first 5 minutes of the fourth quarter. And that's incredible bench production. If you can get that from those guys, and you're not going to get three threes in one quarter from Jeff Green every night. But that's exactly why you go out and sign Jeff Green. And I know it was just a minimum contract, but Jeff Green got you a win. And, you know, considering you spend $120 million on a salary cap, and you try and win 50 games a year. I mean, if you were to break that down just in how much you're paying each player to get you a victory, I mean, Jeff Green's almost worth what you paid him already, from one game. So getting a minimum contract guy like Jeff Green to come in and help you win, and if he can continue to do that and really just play the role of spot-up shooter, when I'm open, I'm going to shoot it, and when I'm not, I'm going to keep moving the ball. There's value to that for the Jazz, and Emmanuel Mudiay has been great, and I think it becomes very interesting as we get Dante Exum back tonight against the Memphis Grizzlies. What happens now to those backup point guard minutes? Because the Jazz said we're not going to make him a backup point guard, and that's exclusively what Emmanuel Mudiay has played, but you got to find minutes for Dante Exum if you want him to be a part of the rotation.
I think you're right. I think he comes in and he plays a different position, but who's he going to play best with? That's really the question I have, because if you just throw the second teamers out there, and let's say you put him in there, and you put him in with, I don't know, let's say Emmanuel or Joe or Jeff Green, right there you're looking at that and you're like, who's our shooter? Because you're thinking, well, Joe, but Joe's kind of initiating the offense, or maybe Emmanuel's initiating it, but you talked about this before. Emmanuel's offense is just way different than Joe. I mean, Joe's looking at the whole court. Emmanuel, he's very deliberate in going to the basket and then maybe passing it out. He's not that type of guy where he can see the entire court.
He doesn't run a system. He runs a play. And his play is pick and roll, or let me beat my guy off the dribble and get to the rim. And either way, it's about getting to the mid-range and in, and then making a decision there. But he doesn't really seem to come out and run this whole system that the Jazz run, where, you know, you saw Mike Conley really do it well against Golden State, where they picked that team apart and just realized all the defensive deficiencies they had, and Conley recognized that. I think Moutier is really more of a one-track mind, which is get to the basket and score, or get to the basket and kick the ball out. And he's done it well so far this year.
Which makes me think that Dante Exum, that maybe the first minutes we see for him are with more starters than with more bench players. That's my opinion right now. I think that he would benefit with being with the starters on the floor, so that takes a lot of pressure off of him. I know he wants to drive to the basket. I know he wants to complete layups. I know he wants to pass it out to guys, too, but right now, I think it's more about him just feeling comfortable. And I think if you put him out there with some starters, I think he's going to feel a lot more comfortable than if you put him with the bench players right now. It's going to be interesting. Who does he take minutes away from? Because you'd probably not say Moutier. It's not going to be from Joe Ingles. I wouldn't think so. Who's he going to take minutes away from right now? I'm not sure there are a lot of minutes right now for Dante, but they have to fit him in somehow.
Yeah, the Jazz play a 9-man rotation. Most NBA teams play 9 to 10. A couple of play 8, a couple of play 11, but like 90% of the teams play 9 men or 10 men. And Quinn Snyder traditionally has played a 9-man rotation. So finding this 10th spot for Dante is interesting, because it's not something we've seen Quinn Snyder do a whole lot, certainly not recently with the Jazz. But let's just kind of walk around. If you were to do a straight substitution pattern, which 10 players makes sense because you have 5 starters and 5 players coming off the bench. So Moutier subs in for Mike Conley. I guess you could have Exum come in for Donovan Mitchell.
Okay.
And then you have Joe Ingles come in for Royce O'Neal. You have Jeff Green come in for Bojan Bogdanovic. And then you have Tony Bradley. And then when Ed Davis comes back, Ed Davis come in for Rudy Gobert. And that makes sense if you want to do it that way, and you can kind of just slowly pick pieces out. But the first sub of the game now for the Jazz is traditionally Donovan Mitchell, and he goes out at about the 6-minute mark, and that's when Joe Ingles comes in, and then Joe Ingles plays with Mike Conley, and then Mike Conley subs out at the 2-minute mark, and then Moutier comes in at that point with Donovan Mitchell, and he checks in for Royce O'Neal, who goes out. So it really does start to get convoluted and crazy, and then you really do have to just look at kind of the raw minute breakdown that everyone's playing and say, well, are you going to take minutes away from Moutier right now? He's got, what, 19 minutes a game, 18 minutes a game? It's not a ton, and he's good in those minutes. I don't think the Jazz are better by taking those away and giving them to Dante Exum. And the Jazz offense has been really rough sometimes when Donovan Mitchell's not on the floor. So don't take minutes away from Donovan Mitchell. I mean, maybe one or two, but can Dante come in and succeed in 5 piecemeal minutes a game? Does he need 8? Does he need 15 to make an impact? I mean, I think that is the hard part. The nice thing, I think, as an imagined role I could see is, and Cleon, I think we've seen this, Royce O'Neal is kind of this defensive specialist for the Jazz. In fact, he goes a lot of games where he has 1 shot. I think that's what he did against Brooklyn the other night. He had 0 shots earlier in the season. So if you can always have that defensive specialist on the floor, especially as a wing player, you're probably going to be in good shape. And Dante Exum's a good defensive player on the wing. So if you could sub Royce out and bring in Dante Exum, and just say, well, we're always going to have that guy who's fast and aggressive and plays hard defense on the wing. There's a need for that, and that's the good thing. What he does is a need that every team has. Where you play him, I think, is a different question and harder to figure out.
It's interesting. When the Jazz signed Emmanuel Moutier, I saw a lot of opinion out there saying, well, why did you do that? Because you already have Dante Exum, and who's better? I mean, I saw a lot of people out there giving their opinions that Dante Exum was the better player, that he was the guy that the Jazz were going to, you know, as long as he was healthy, the Jazz were going to ride or die with Dante Exum, and he was definitely a better player than Emmanuel Moutier. But now we've seen that Emmanuel has acquitted himself very nicely in this offense,
yep.
and he has done a lot of good things for this Jazz team. Is he perfect? No. But he's a good guard off the bench, and who knows how things are going to go going forward, but I'm not sure you just sit there and say, yeah, let's just take minutes away from him, because he's found a nice rhythm with the guys who he's playing with right now, and he's been very successful in doing it.
And the argument was that Emmanuel Mudiay, so they both had their strengths before the season, Dante Exum and Emmanuel Mudiay. Mudiay is a much better offensive player, but was an awful defensive player. Exum's a really good defensive player, but is a pretty awful offensive player. And the argument was that Emmanuel Mudiay's defensive weaknesses were worse than Dante Exum's offensive weaknesses. So if you're just going by net positive that these players are, you're going to go with Dante Exum because he does less poorly than Emmanuel Mudiay, which is a really, you know,
no,
picking the lesser of two evils is not a fun thing to do. The nice thing is, you're not looking at Emmanuel Mudiay this year and saying, ooh, he's getting killed on the defensive side of the ball. He's not. He's really playing well on the defensive side of the ball, and Quinn Snyder's talked about that a lot as well, of how much he goes out there and recognizes what they're trying to do, is willing to be a good teammate and trying to recognize what they're trying to do defensively, and is not going out and getting, you know, torched by backup point guards night in and night out, and that has been something that has happened to him. So if that's the case, unless Dante Exum comes in and is some, all of a sudden, I mean, at least average or better than average offensive player mixed with his defense, I don't think Mudiay's minutes are the ones I'm touching. And then I don't know if I'm going into Joe Ingles minutes or if I'm going into Royce O'Neal's minutes and thinking I'm going to get more from Dante. And that's the, I mean, that's sports. That's the hard part. You compete for your job. You know, it's a competitive business. You compete for a living. And if you're not the 10th best, or you're not better than the other nine players on the floor in front of you, you don't deserve to get minutes in front of them. And then there's only so many positionally that he could play. And there's four guards in the Jazz rotation, if you count Joe Ingles as a guard, that are clearly better than Dante Exum, if you assume Moutier's better. And I think this year he has been.
I want to go back to his offense, because one of the things that we've noticed from him in the past is his reluctance to shoot three-pointers. So then when he's left open for a three-pointer, because you know it's going to happen, what is he going to do? My answer would be, I'm going to say, for right now, because he's trying to impress the coaches, he wants to do the right thing, I think at times he's going to probably put his head down and try and get to the basket, which is good, because it's better than hesitating on whether or not he should, you know, pass the ball or shoot the ball. I'd much rather see him go to the basket than doing anything else, or than hesitating, I guess I should say. And so that's my big question to him. What is he going to do when he gets the ball and he's out beyond the 3-point line? They're like, go ahead, shoot.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to see him hesitate. I'd rather see him do something else, or maybe even pass the ball.
And that's the thing about Royce O'Neal. I mean, I bet if we pull up his numbers right now, I bet you Royce O'Neal's right around 50% as a 3-point shooter this season.
Yeah, he is right around that.
He's at 52% this year, which is dead eye. I mean, 52, you know, anything over 40 is great, and he's at 52 right now. Now, he only takes two a game, which is funny. He's actually taking exact number of threes per game this year that he was last year, Royce O'Neal is, but he's up 14 percentage points, which is crazy. That's a huge jump, and a small sample size, but that's amazing.
That also has to deal with who the Jazz have now. I mean, he's now wide open a lot of the times because of everyone who he plays with. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Conley, Bogdanovich, mm-hmm. he gets wide open looks as a result, and that's why you have shooters on the floor. I mean, it makes even your lesser guys better offensive players. So does that also benefit Dante Exum? Can he raise his three-point shooting up to 38, 39%? Because then we start to erase some of those offensive weaknesses that he has, if he can do that. Plus the fact that he's pretty dangerous in transition. That's probably where he is best as an NBA player. If he can rebound and go, or not even rebound, but just run up the floor and beat his defender down the floor, can the Jazz get easy looks that way? Because that would be a nice advantage too, where I don't think this team has run very much yet, and I think some of that's just newness to the system. It's like anyone's first day at work. You're not going to do things fast. You get much faster the longer you've been on the job. I think the Jazz offense will continue to do that. Dante Exum is a one-man fast break. I mean, he's De'Aaron Fox, John Wall level speed.
Yeah.
If you can give him the ball or get him the ball, he can really push it. And actually, he has a really good front court running mate who can run as well, and that's Jeff Green. So ideally, that bench unit could run a little bit more and get some easy baskets that way. And, you know, fast break points are killer, so those will really hurt an opposing team.
Let's play a little game of what if now, and I've only got two questions on the what if. And maybe the first one isn't really a what if, but let's look out, prognosticate a little bit, or look back and then prognosticate. You know, when Donovan Mitchell was drafted, I remember going up or watching games at the Huntsman Center and watching he and Dante play together, and it looked like, oh, is this the backcourt of the future? And that was still with the thought process that maybe Dante could be a point guard. Now you could almost say, well, if Mike Conley eventually says, see you later, you know, could they go to Dante and Donovan? Donovan's the main ball handler, ball carrier. I'm talking football now. Ball handler. And then Dante kind of plays off of him. And that would, of course, include him being able to shoot from the outside. And I'm talking about Dante Exum. So, are those dreams over now? Because I would probably say yes. I think Dante is now to the point where they just need... I think Dante's more of a bench player than anything else. I'm not sure we're ever going to see the backcourt of the future be Dante Exum and Donovan Mitchell.
I don't think he has the feel for the game to be much more than that. I mean, he's just never really displayed like this all overwhelming ability, not from a knowledge perspective, to take over a game. He has physically at times. In fact, I think it was 2 years ago when he was coming back from an injury from the shoulder. I think it was against Memphis. He had a fantastic game, and it was like, oh, he's so fast. It's dominating this slower Memphis team. They just have no idea how to deal with somebody with his speed, and that's absolutely that's a weapon. There's a reason fast guys work in the NBA. Fast speed kills, and that's true in every sport, certainly in the NBA as well. I don't think he has the feel to do it night in and night out. So, no, I don't think he can be a starter. He needs to be a passable three-point shooter. I don't know if his body can hold up getting into the paint and drawing contact. And I mean, and I think of all of his injuries. I mean, his shoulder, he got landed on, right? When he dislocated his shoulder in the paint. First time he tore his knee with Team Australia, he was doing jump stopping into the paint. He tore his patellar tendon last year, jump stopping in the paint. I don't know if he can play inside. His body just might not be able to handle the physicality.
And the last what if, or I guess question we still have with Dante Exum, is he going to be on this team by the end of the season, or are we going to see him? Are now the Jazz going to say, yeah, we need to get him some minutes because we need to see if we can get him onto another team and maybe get someone back in return?
If there is a piece that the Jazz feel like they're one spot away from winning a championship, and the hard thing is they've already included two future draft picks to go to Memphis for Mike Conley. If the Jazz felt like they were one piece away and you needed a mid-level salary to trade, the only one that really makes sense is Dante Exum. Because you're not going to trade Conley or Donovan or Rudy or Boyan, you know, Joe Ingles. You just extended him. Royce O'Neal makes $800,000 a year, so you're just not going to get equal value back for him. That's where Dante Exum could potentially have value, is to say, hey, he's worth, what is it, $9 million a year? That's a decent mid-level salary chip. If some team says, hey, we're losing this year, we don't want to pay this guy this much money, we would rather just get a young piece that we think maybe we have a year of building on, or this guy's really unhappy playing with us because we're losing and he wants to win a championship, we'll trade him for Dante Exum. There's some potential for that type of wiggle room. But also, like we mentioned, Royce O'Neal's making $1.5 million, whatever low number he is this year. Odds are he prices himself out of the Jazz next year. And then you need a defensive specialist, and you've already got one under contract, and that's Dante Exum. So that's also the value. If he can prove he can stay healthy, which he's never done before, he steps in and replaces Royce O'Neal next year. And Royce O'Neal might be looking at $9 million a year with some other team that recognizes the value that he does have.
I would say that unless the Jazz get a killer deal like what you're talking about and they need that piece, I think in some ways, maybe in the back of their mind, they're saying, we've invested a lot in Dante.
Yeah.
We want to see him succeed, and maybe it's because Royce may leave. That's just my opinion. Yeah. I have no information or knowledge or anything like that. That's just my gut feel that they'd like to see Dante succeed, and so maybe they'd like to keep him around unless they get someone who's going to come back and is just going to be able to help this team put him over the top to get to the NBA Finals.
There was some belief that last year the reason the Jazz didn't get the Mike Conley trade done at the trade deadline was because they didn't want to include Dante Exum. And that was, and I think Dennis Lindsay has come out and said Dante's name never even got brought up. I don't know if that was from the Jazz side or if that was from Memphis side. Did Memphis not want him at all? Or did the Jazz say he's off the table? He's a young piece. We just signed. We want to keep him around.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. Next, we're going to talk about three-pointers, Mike Conley and the team when it comes to shooting three-pointers. That's coming up next right here on the Jazz Notes podcast.
I'm Dave Cauley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast Cold. Don't miss Cold's new Season 3, where I look into the unsolved disappearance of Cherie Warren, a woman last seen leaving her job at a Salt Lake City office in 1985. Police cast suspicion on Cherie's estranged husband and boyfriend, but never made any arrests or recovered Cherie's remains. Find Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie, anywhere you get your podcasts.
All right, welcome back into the Jazz Notes podcast. When I was talking to Mike Conley before he headed out to play in Memphis, most of our conversation, and I'm not just talking about me, I'm talking about the entire media, most of our conversation focused or revolved around Mike playing his first game back in Memphis, where he spent his first 12 seasons. But right before we were done with him, I did have one quick question for him. I said, Mike, you've already attempted 64 three-pointers this year, and your career high, which was, by the way, just last season, and I can't remember what it was, but it was somewhere in the 240s, I believe, and so I'm going to probably blow it there. But I said, your career high is 240. You've already shot 64, and that kind of surprised him to know he's already shot 64 three-pointers this season. And then he said, well, this is all because it's coming in the offense. And really, when you think about it, you mentioned it before our break. You said Memphis was a team that was just not used to speed. And that's really what they were built on when Mike Conley was there the first time. Gee, the only time, yeah, he was there. When Mike Conley was there, it was slow. It was grit and grind. They didn't, at least he didn't attempt a lot of three-pointers, and he probably relied a lot on, you know, Zach Randolph and also Marc Gasol.
Yep.
But, and then they provided some offense for him when he threw the ball into them. He's already attempted 64 three-pointers, and it's coming in the offense. It looks like he's going to shatter the previous record he's had. Has he shot too much, though, or do you think he's right on? Because I think he's kind of right on. I mean, they're going to provide it for him. They're providing guys who can actually initiate offense, which I'm not sure is what he had also in Memphis. They're actually providing him with opportunities to shoot the ball, too. I think it's good. I think it's liberating for him, and I think it's great that he's already shot 64 three-pointers, and I think he should just keep firing away because I think he'll turn out to be a good shooter in the end.
Yeah, it's funny. His numbers have spiked the last few years where he averages 5.8 threes a year this year, or a game this year. Last year it was 6.1. The year before that it was 6.4. And the year before that it was 6.1. And he's actually shot pretty well in each of those 3 years, with the exception of the middle year, but he only played 12 games. He was dealing with an ankle or a heel injury, and they ended up pulling him out. Maybe it was even an Achilles. They pulled him out, and he missed most of that season. So he's been taking threes. He needs to stay healthy, and that's always his problem. He rarely plays more than 70 games. So if he can play more than 75 games with the Jazz, you're right, he should absolutely shatter that by a huge number. And then I don't feel like Mike Conley's taking a lot of bad shots. I mean, just my gut tells me watching him, he's not taking forced threes for the most part. And I don't know if anyone on this team is made. And if anyone is, it's Bojan Bogdanović. And I love when he forces threes, because the more he shoots, the yeah, better the Jazz look. So I think it's the right number of shots. I think he's right. They're coming in the offense. I think Quinn Snyder loves his guys shooting threes. I think that's exactly what he wants to do. If you get open looks and you've got a guy like Rudy Gobert who can help you get open looks because of the pressure he puts on a defense spreading the floor, getting to the rim, and how much attention Donovan Mitchell gets on kickouts or on drives that he can kick out to Mike Conley, take as many as you can. Because, yeah, I know he's only shooting 34% right now, which isn't great, but it's also not, you know, it's not below average. And certainly, if you're just looking from a raw points per possession, you know, you're getting over 1 point per possession if he's shooting threes and shooting over 33%, and he's shooting 34%. And each of the last 3 years, like we mentioned, those numbers have been higher. So I bet you that rebounds 36, 37, maybe up to 38%. And then if he's taking six threes a game and hitting 38%, he becomes super efficient.
Well, and that's why they signed him, because Ricky Rubio, who was shooting, right, what was it, around 30% yeah, from out in the three-point range. But it wasn't just that. It was what we talked about before with Dante Exum. He would hesitate.
Yeah.
He'd be like, should I shoot this? No, I'm going to pass
right.
it. No, I'm going to drive. No,
right.
I'm going to do... It wasn't always clear with him. I don't think you find that a lot with Mike Conley right now. I think that when he is open, he is wanting to take the three-point shot because he knows he can make it.
So. That's how you go 1 for 15 or whatever he did early in the season. I mean, you want the shots, and you believe you can make the shots.
Yeah.
You go for 1 for 15. I don't know if Rubio does that a whole lot. I don't remember him doing it with the Jazz. Donovan Mitchell's done it, but Donovan Mitchell thinks the shots are going to go in, and I want a guy who thinks the shots are going to go in. And the reason Conley does believe that is because historically they have.
Three-pointers for the Utah Jazz, though. This is an interesting stat. They've attempted 319 this season. That ranks 26th in the NBA. Granted, they've only played just over an eighth of their games, or 11 games so far this season. Last season, they had 2,789 attempts. That was ninth in the NBA. So what gives so far this season, Ben? Is it that thing where... You had talked about that you'd like to see the Jazz run a little bit more, and that they're just not quite used to doing that yet. Is this kind of the same thing? Are they just not quite in sync yet to be back at that level where they're attempting more three-pointers per game?
I think there's a couple things going on. One, I think they play slow, and that's an issue.
Yeah, that's true.
So when you play slow, you're just going to have fewer attempts. I'd love to look at three-point attempts per game, to mix that up a little bit also, where, you know, you can kind of draw that out a little bit, or three-point percentage as far as just raw shot percentage, not field goal percentage. But I think a lot of it has to do with so much newness that guys are hesitating on when they're going to shoot. And I know we were just talking about how Conley hasn't done that, but I do think you still see the Jazz overpassing on the perimeter sometimes and passing up great shots for good shots, which is the opposite of what Quinn Snyder wants to do. He wants to pass up good shots for great shots. And I think sometimes you do get a good Joe Ingles shot that he'll pass off, or a good Mike Conley shot that he'll kick over to Joe Ingles or to Emmanuel Mudiay. And it's like, now you're probably better shooting that ball. And I think that's some newness of just recognizing, like, hey, I'm wide open. I need to take this shot, or this is going to be a shot for me here, instead of I'm going to catch and I'm going to put the ball on the floor. Because when you're uneasy or when you're unsure of what you're doing, I think that's kind of your default, your de facto, which is why big guys always get charges. I mean, they catch the ball running and they don't know what to do, and they think, well, I'll put the ball on the ground and I'll run into somebody. I think innately you catch it and you put the ball on the go and attack the rim, which is a great thing to teach young players. It's probably not how they really play in the NBA anymore. If you got an open shot from three, you have to take that shot. So I think that's some of what it is. It's just being unsure of, hey, am I doing this wrong? Is this a bad shot? Is this the best shot we think we're looking for? And you just have to get to realize, yeah, at some point, those are the best shots you're trying to get, and that's what Quinn Snyder's offense is designed to do.
I did put a question mark in here, and I know this is not the reason, but I thought, is it because Jay Crowder was taking way too many
threes? Took a lot of bad threes last year.
and that goes back to what we were talking about a little bit earlier about not hesitating. You know, being able... Think about Mike D'Antoni. I mean, Mike D'Antoni is one of those coaches. He tells everyone, whether they're good or bad, if they're open, just take the shot. I'm not going to be mad if you take the shot, if you're wide open. And I think that's, I'm wondering, just like what you said, if they're just not, they're just like, let me do it. And Joe's kind of the king of overpassing right now.
Sure.
I love Joe Ingles, but sometimes you just want him to take more shots. And we've talked about that so far on the show. I do want to say that Ben was right. I'm going to come out and say, Ben's right, because we were talking about how have these players played so far this year. And I came out and I said, I want to see more from Rudy Gobert. And you're like, I think Rudy's playing great.
Yeah.
And then I looked at the fourth quarter stats, offensive defensive ratings, or offensive defensive ratings of players on the court on the fourth quarter. And Rudy Gobert has been tremendous on offense in the fourth quarter. The team is scoring 112.6 points possession, when he is on the court in the fourth quarter. And you saw that the other night against the Brooklyn Nets. He is tremendous because they don't have anyone else like that. That you don't have a Derek Favors that's going to come in and be able to spell you. Because when he's off the floor, the offensive rating is 85.4 in the fourth quarter.
Right.
They need him on the floor in the fourth quarter, because though he doesn't have a jump shot or a hook shot or anything like that, he is so close to the basket, you need him on the court just to be a threat at all times.
Yeah, a good example was that great Mike Conley pass out of the corner to Rudy Gobert. He's underneath the hoop and he catches it right at the rim. When he catches it, there's three guys around him. I mean, that's a defense who realizes this guy, if he catches the ball within 5 feet, he's going to dunk it. And that's the best shot you can get in basketball. And Rudy does that. So he draws a ton of attention. And as a result of drawing attention, you're a big guy getting that much attention is going to create open opportunities for everybody else. And he's just so efficient as it is. You know, when he does get those looks, he scores for the most part, or he goes to the free throw line. And again, even let's say he's a 50% free throw shooter. Okay, you don't like that, but that's 1 point per possession, which is very passable in the NBA. It's not amazing, but it's 1 point per possession. If you can do that, I mean, that's okay from Rudy, especially when he, you know, his efficiency is so high on the actual shots he takes, because they're usually dunks. So you can get away with all of that.
And Ben's right again. I'm wrong. It's so funny because I think we look at guys like Rudy, and I by the way, everyone, if you don't know, I'm much older than Ben. So I go back and I look and I keep thinking of the Kareems, the Hakeems, the Shaqs. Maybe not Shaq so much, but the guys who had post moves, and you just don't find that anymore.
No.
And that's fine.
Right.
That's fine now in today's NBA that you don't have that. And so I'll go back and I'll say I'm wrong, because I'm sitting there saying I want more out of Rudy, but Rudy's given the Jazz and a tremendous amount on the offensive rim, just being who he is, and that's just being close to the basket. I don't know. It would be nice if he did a three-pointer, everyone.
Also, the last two games, though, he gave you 25 points and he gave you 18 points. So we've seen his offense really spike, where he had not scored a whole lot previously in the season. And now he's had his two highest scoring outputs. I think before that it was 15. Like, he should have games where he accidentally gets 15 points. But his points are secondary. They come off of assists or they come off of missed shots. They're inherently secondary for the most part. I know he actually had a couple of kind of post moves against Jared Allen in Brooklyn, which were nice to see. I just don't think that's ever going to be his game. But when his shots are secondary, it requires other guys doing their jobs right as well. So I think that's a really good sign for the team that his numbers are going up, because that means the pick and roll is being run correctly. That means good shots are being taken that are drawing attention that give Rudy an opportunity to get putbacks.
Last quick thing before we get out of here. I don't know if we're going to do another podcast before the Jazz play the Minnesota Timberwolves on Monday night. But I'm just curious about your thoughts about the Timberwolves. They're 7-4 before the weekend.
Yep.
Pretty impressive, and Andrew Wiggins is actually, well, Karl Anthony Towns, of course, is impressive all in and of itself, but Andrew Wiggins has been impressive. Yep. I guess looking at before the season, I looked at that those two games, they're going to play Minnesota back-to-back. I looked at those two games as wins.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that's a gimme anymore.
I think you got to split home and homes, and that's what it is. It's a weird, you play, what, here Monday, there Wednesday?
Yeah.
You have to split those. You can't lose both of them, but both teams approach it. It's hard to beat a team twice in a row, so it would be a failure to not win at least one of them. And, you know, the Jazz are good enough that they should be tough enough to have a real shot to win both of them. Wiggins is averaging, 25 points a game, and he's shooting well from the three-point line. His rebounds and assists are way up. He's been impressive this year. And you know who's actually else been very good from that same draft class is Jabari Parker. Jabari's been really good this year as well. So maybe those guys just took a little bit longer to mature. Who else was in that draft class? Dante Exum. Let's see if maybe Dante can come back tonight and live up to what those guys are starting to do this season.
He is Ben Anderson. My name is Cleon Wall. Thanks for downloading and listening to the Jazz Notes podcast. We appreciate it. We'll have more stuff coming up for you next week. Timberwolves, of course, coming up next week. More games coming up next week. We'll have coverage of that on KSLSports.com. Thanks a lot for listening. We'll talk to you soon. Bye.
A gun in the face.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
Started 2 years of horror for an American in Venezuela.
They said, you need to give us your phone and get ready because you're coming with us.
I'm Becky Bruce, and I spent a year researching and piecing together Josh and Tammy Holt's story about their ordeal in a notorious prison.
That's when everything started to turn bad. We had another pound on the door. Boom, boom, boom. And there was the police once again.
You can binge all of the episodes of Hope in Darkness on KSLPodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.